Welcome to the Breeding class. I send greetings from Wright Doyle. I had a long telephone FaceTime conversation with him yesterday, and he said to pass on his greetings. Some of you don't know Wright, but many of you do. They're in Texas now, and I thought we had our computer problems solved, but we don't yet. So you'll have to endure a little bit of awkwardness here.
You're not angry this morning.
I'm suppressing it. Don't forget tonight, we're having a potluck at our house, and it's a good time. There's no agenda other than just coming and getting to know one another, talk to one another, have a good time of fellowship. You're, of course, all welcome. We're talking about, this is a series on anxiety and anger, very appropriately. And the flip side of that is shalom, or peace. And a good definition of shalom, and I hadn't heard this before this week when I was poking around, but I like it. The way it's supposed to be. That's what shalom is. It's the way it's supposed to be. When things are the way God intends them to be, that's shalom, both in terms of our inner countenance and outward circumstances. This notion of shalom, or it's translated peace usually, really is a big theme in Jesus' teaching. For example, in John chapter 14 and verse 27, we read these words, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." In other words, the flip side of fear and being troubled is this peace, the shalom. And he's saying basically, the peace that I'm giving you is different than, it's not like the peace the world gives you. The way the world gives us peace is basically by changing our circumstances, usually. If I can just have a job that appreciates me and that I love, if I can just have perfect health, if my kids would just behave, if my mate would just behave, or whatever it might be, my boss or whatever. If you change my circumstances, then I'm going to have peace. I won't be anxious. But that's not the kind of peace that Christ offers. And that's significant. "These things I have spoken to you, so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation. But take courage, I have changed the world." No. This is the way we'd like to read it. He doesn't promise to change the world. He wants to help us overcome the world. In other words, the world's going to remain full of trouble, full of anxiety, full of disease, full of dark spots, the valleys of the shadow of death. It's going to be all around us. It's how we respond to that. I've worn this one out, but you haven't heard the last of it because I keep telling this to myself and to those that will hear me. It's not what happens to us. It's how we respond to what happens to us. God's Spirit does not anoint our circumstances so much as He anoints our response to our circumstances, no matter what our circumstances might be. And if we have doubts about that, just look at the life of Jesus and the Apostle Paul. Their circumstances were abysmal. They were not good at all. But their response was inspiring and inspired. This photograph is one that I'll never forget. It's the Brittany coast of France, a lighthouse. This is not a Photoshop picture. This is a real photograph that someone caught of a giant wave hitting this lighthouse, and you've got this guy standing in the doorway in apparently complete peace or lack of anxiety. I don't know what happened to that water when it wrapped around that lighthouse, but it's a powerful picture. And when I see this, I see this is a picture, really, of what we have in Christ. We're talking about anxiety and anger. We've talked about anxiety in the last several weeks. Now, this week and next week, we're going to talk about anger. Anxiety and anger are linked. And here's the way I describe both of them. Anxiety is a negative audit of the future. Something awful might happen. Anger is a negative audit of the past. Something awful has happened. And usually when that happens, two results, shame or blame. Shame if I'm at fault, blame if you're at fault. Both are basically expressions of anger and of wrath. Anxiety and anger share three things in common: false expectations, a narrow perspective, just seeing what's right in front of us, not seeing the big picture, and confused priorities, majoring on minors. Things that aren't so important become important. And this causes anxiety. This also causes, eventually, anger. The example that I think is important for us to see here is found in, I'm going to have to doctor this a little bit, if I can. Well, it won't let me for some reason. There we go. I'm sorry I have to do this. It works really well when I had it worked out, but this is the story of Mary and Martha. Familiar story. In Luke 10. Now, as they were traveling along, he, that is Jesus, entered a certain village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. And she had a sister called Mary, who, moreover, was listening to the Lord's words seated at his feet. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations. And she came up to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me." But the Lord said to, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only a few things are necessary, really only one. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her." This story, very popular, familiar story, is not only about Martha's anxiety, it's about the relationship between Martha's expectations and her anxiety and her anger. When her expectations are set in a certain way, she's distracted by her priorities. She was basically being a good Jewish host. She basically had concluded that if I do not do my duties as a host, if I'm not hospitable, I insult my guests. That's a part of the culture she grew up in. That was most important to her. And it was not wrong. It was not wrong at all. It just was not the most important thing. But it was at this point to her. And then when she finds herself unable to do that without help and needs Mary to help her, and Mary's distracted, Martha doesn't see herself as distracted. Mary's the one that's distracted. There's a time in which you can listen to Jesus, but right now it is not that time. And she's turning to Jesus and says, "Don't you get it? Don't you see what's happening here? Well, tell her to get over here and do her work. Help me out." Her anxiety turns to anger. This is what happens so often in our lives. We have expectations. I expect to come here, and I expect this technology to work. And I said, "Oh, no, not this again." This was last week, the same thing. I called Apple, spent about an hour on Apple. They said, "Your computer is not the problem. There's something in this room that's bugging your computer." So I called the church, and they reprogrammed this, and got here this morning. It's going to be solved. Not solved. The point is, we live in a world where anxiety, and this is no big thing, believe me. And I have to tell myself, my perspective's too narrow. Who cares whether it works or not? Well, I do. I spent 15 hours putting this together. But the point is, when I see a broader perspective, the world goes on. This is not the big thing. But for all of us, there are things that become big things when we've invested ourselves in them in some way. Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 13. "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." I've quoted that passage often, a lot. But it's a beautiful passage. It tells the story of Israel and of us. We make two mistakes. We don't chase after the true riches, and we invest ourselves in the wrong things. And when we invest ourselves in the wrong things, when we have false messiahs, and they disappoint us, and they will, we wind up being angry. anxious, frustrated. And then we make bad decisions, usually. This is the path of Martha's restless soul. It starts with seeking water in empty cisterns, where basically her traditions became more important than everything else for her. She was focused really narrowly on what her responsibility was as a Jewish host. That leads to false expectations. If this doesn't take place, everything else is not going to work. This basically is going to topple the whole building if this foundation is not made. She manipulates others to meet her needs, or tries to, becomes confused when expectations are not met, and then if they are met, she's prideful, feels good about having accomplished her goal, or if they aren't met, angry, anxious, and eventually despair and discouragement. That's a path all of us have gone down. When I ask, when we interview people for a staff position at the church here, one of the questions I'd ask them always is, how do you handle anger? And this is an answer I've often gotten. Well, anger is not one of my problems. Okay, you've told me how you handle it. You repress it, suppress it. If you live in a broken world as a broken person, you're going to be angry. The question is not the anger. It's what do you do? How do you manage it? How do you see the anger? Where does it lead you? What do you do next when you feel when you have feelings of anger or anxiety? What happens next? That's what's important. James 4, chapters 1 and 2. Verses 1 and 2. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire but do not have, so you kill. You covet but do not get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. Here James puts his finger on it. External conflicts, quarreling and fighting, wars, are the result of unresolved internal conflicts. Our anxiety and our anger is going to spill out onto our relationships. Now, this is true not only of us individually, at a family level, a church level, a community level. It's true nationally. Where do international problems come from? Ultimately, they come from personal problems that aren't resolved. Frustrations, misplaced priorities, false expectations. And if we're going to solve social problems, what James is suggesting, you start by looking at your own heart. And you've got to solve those problems, first of all, in your own heart before you can become a peacemaker. Now, next week, we're going to talk about peacemaking. And the first step in peacemaking, we're going to see, is that you've got to basically have peace in yourself. If you have an agenda of anger and anxiety, you're not going to be a peacemaker. You make peace by first finding peace in yourself. The common misconceptions about anger. Healthy Christians never get angry. Healthy people living as broken people in a broken world are going to be angry. Angry feelings are evil and should be repressed. Sometimes we get that impression. This is a very common Christian response, quote unquote, to anger. Well, it's embarrassing to be angry. I'm supposed to be a Christian. So I just repress it or suppress it. That is not healthy, because you're not going to be able to destroy it that way or manage it that way. It'll just creep out someplace else. Sooner or later, you're going to explode, or you're going to withdraw, or you're going to be incapable of loving and giving when you have to show up to love your enemy. It is unhealthy to suppress anger. This is the opposite problem. Angry feelings, therefore, act them out. Now, some psychiatrists would say it's good, and they are right here, it's good to express your true feelings. But what oftentimes is not emphasized is how you do that. Sometimes people get a green light for basically taking a baseball bat to their problems. That is not going to help. Managing anger has to do, to a large extent, with how you handle it internally and how you express feelings externally. Anger and hostility are two sides of the same coin. Not necessarily. Maxicato said, and we'll look at this his quote next week. In the church, for example, he says, conflict is unavoidable. Combat is. Conflict is something we can handle, but not combat. Spiritually, anger has no constructive purpose. Anger can be a very, very helpful tool. And I'll tell you why. Not because it's justified. It's almost always justified by some rationale. But anger is like the canary in a coal mine. It tells you where your expectations, your perspective, and your priorities are out of line. Where your expectations are unrealistic, your perspective is too narrow, and your priorities are misplaced. Anger will tell you, so will anxiety. When you have those feelings, the light goes on the dash of your soul and says, bing, 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 and says, trace this back and ask yourself, why are you anxious and angry? And you're going to find something that is unplugged with respect to your spiritual life and your relationship with God. I like this. Anger is one letter short of danger. And this is expressed in passages like this, Psalm 37, verse 8. This is not something that's new to you. You've heard this before and experienced it. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. And you may not be murdering your enemy or the person who's hurt you or the person who's disappointed you, but you are robbed when you are angry and don't manage it well. You're robbed of the energy you need to worship and to serve lovingly. It's very difficult to love your enemy when you're trying basically to get even with your enemy. And this is something that is oftentimes ignored in the dynamics of Christian discipleship. In order for us to be free to love, we've got to be able to manage anxiety and anger. How do you manage it? Be angry and yet do not sin. Do not let sin go down in your anger. And do not give the devil an opportunity. That passage is well worn. You've heard it before. The devil is not in our anger so much as how he attempts us to respond to it. And this passage in Paul's letter suggests that anger is not the problem. It's basically our failure to deal with it that is the problem. I like this quote from Phyllis Diller. Don't go to bed angry. Stay up and fight. this is gorgeous. Ah, so you think I'm cute when I'm angry. Well, get ready because I'm about to become gorgeous. When angry with someone, it helps to sit down and think about the problem. This is not the way you manage anger. Anger could also be a trailhead leading to spiritual insight and peace. It need not result in blame. It's your fault. You've got to change. Or shame. It's my fault. I'm a bad person. That's the world's and our nature's impulse to let anger lead us in those directions. Anger can lead us in a third direction, and that is insight. And again, going back to something we mentioned in the last 2 weeks, managing anger is like managing anxiety. It has a lot to do with the wisdom of our expectations, the breadth of our perspective, and the ordering of our priorities. If our expectations are realistic, if our perspective is broad, and if our orientation, if our priorities are ordered properly, we can manage anxiety and anger. We can have shalom, or a measure of it. Let me try to give an example, if I can. I'm thinking of a quote from Dr. Oz. The opposite of anger is not calmness, it's empathy. When I first heard this, I said, now hold it. Let me see if I get this. Empathy, anger. And the lights came on. Now, Doctor, as you know, I quote people here who aren't necessarily evangelical Christians. Dr. Oz is a Muslim. But he's right. Just because he's a Muslim or just because Phyllis Diller is not an evangelical Christian doesn't mean she doesn't have insight as a comedian. As a matter of fact, part of the reason I quote people who are not evangelical Christians is I want you to learn how to listen to everyone. Everyone bears the image of God and has light. That doesn't mean they're right in every area. Our problem is people are black and white in the sense of all right or all wrong. That's a terrible mistake to make. Jesus saw value in people the Pharisees wouldn't touch. Jesus showed great respect to people that ordinarily his culture had no respect for. We do ourselves a great disfavor when we don't listen to everyone. That doesn't mean we follow everybody's comments, but we recognize there is much to learn there. If we miss this, we miss something. But here's his point. We can't love people that we don't empathize with. I've had a number of experiences in my life that stuck with me in an embarrassing way. One of them had to do with an interchange I had with a car dealer back in 1972. It was that long ago. I was shopping for a used car, and I went into a dealership right here on the 15501. And I saw exactly the car I was looking for. It just had been traded in. They hadn't even cleaned it up. And they not only on that very hour bought the car, they sold it to me in the same hour. That's the way you turn a product around. I was thrilled. But, of course, the car is not purchased and you drive it off the lot. So I drove it off the lot. And he said, bring it back tomorrow. We'll detail it for you. I brought it back the next day. And the salesman was not there, but the manager was. The manager did not know about the circumstances of what had taken place the day before when I bought the car, and I said I brought my car back to be detailed. And he started into a tirade, and he basically, in a loud voice, chased me out of the dealership. And I was just stunned and shocked. And the salesman happened to be in the back and saw the whole thing. And he ran outside. I didn't know, what was going on. Ran outside, caught me, and said, take it around back. I'll take care of it. He didn't explain anything, and I never got an apology from the manager. I don't know what happened. But I just remember this. I never went back to that dealership, even though it had changed ownership 3 times. I still wouldn't go back there. I mean, the point is, those kind of things stick with us because we don't often handle anger very well. But then, as I had a chance to think about that, I realized, listen, if he's a manager of a car dealership, he can't treat every customer that way. He wouldn't be in that position. What might have happened to him that day? Did his wife leave him that morning? Did he find out that his kids were arrested because they were selling drugs? Did he get a bad doctor's report? I don't know. But the point is, something probably happened that put him in a position where the way he treated me had nothing to do with how he felt about me. It had all to do with something perhaps that I couldn't control or the dealership couldn't control or only God can control because of misplaced expectations, so forth and so on. And narrow perspective. But that anger that he expressed was now translated to me because if my perspective was narrow as well, then all of a sudden Satan is saying, gotcha! Just spread the disease. Now you go home and you kick your dog. And your dog's going to bite somebody. And it just goes on and on and on and on. Yes! That's the way it works. Now what Jesus says, I don't give you the kind of peace the world gives. I give you a peace that breaks that chain. where you broaden your perspective and you recognize, yes, this person has done something very bad, very inappropriate, very even sinful, harmful, dangerous. But until we are quick to hear and slow to wrath, we're not in a position to love. That's what James is telling us. We've looked at this that passage. Be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger or slow to wrath. Until we basically react angrily, we've got to listen to the big picture and gain the big picture and embrace that big picture. This is why I think what Dr. Oz is saying here is true. The opposite of anger is not calmness. It's seeing the big picture. It's empathizing with those who basically have gotten under our skin.
I wonder if that empathy isn't always also for ourselves. Because when we get really angry at somebody, maybe it's if that person is reminding us of somebody in our past, it might not even be about that person. And asking ourselves, who does this remind me of? Or what is the situation?
Are you suggesting that we have baggage that we've been carrying around that basically have?
or even asking ourselves, how old am I?
Yeah. Yes. No. I think that's a very good insight. I'm not surprising. All of your insights are great insights. but the point is this: when we don't know how to manage anger and anxiety, we put it in our backpack, and it builds up. And then all of a sudden, we find ourselves reacting to things that we say, why am I reacting to this? Why is this pushing my button? And it really isn't pushing my button. It's just basically opening the back sack, and it's the knapsack, and it's coming out. If we don't deal with this stuff, don't let the sun go down on our anger, if we don't manage it, we're going to basically pay a price for that because it's going to creep out and show itself. Where were we here?
Dr. Oz.
Psalm 30. O Lord my God, I cried to you for help, and you healed me. O Lord, you have brought up my soul from Sheol. This is David running from Saul. You have kept me alive that I would not go down to the pit. Then verse 11. You have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosened my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. Now, this is a very interesting psalm for this reason. The Lord here is being worshipped and praised not because he changed David's circumstances. He changed David. David's circumstances remained walking through the valley of the shadow of death. God had made a place for him in the presence of his enemies. A table. He set a table before him in the presence of his enemies. He gave him peace in the storm. He put him in that lighthouse when the waves were breaking around it and gave him peace. Now, when we read this psalm, we automatically assume, oh, God rescued David, and he's promised to rescue us. That bad doctor's report, just ignore it. Don't talk about it, because God will make it go away if you have faith. Or your relationships are in trouble and are painful, but don't worry about that. Just trust the Lord, because he has promised to take it away and make it right. You're right. He's promised to make it right, but not necessarily by taking it away. Maybe by keeping the thorn in the flesh, we learn something, like the Apostle Paul did. The story of Paul's thorn in the flesh and the story of Martha are basically direct opposites of the same issue. Both of them faced situations that they had a right to be angry with. Paul had a thorn in the flesh that was an enemy, that was an instrument of Satan that was frustrating his ministry. His computer didn't work. Martha was committed to hospitality, which was very important, but not the number one priority. And she was focused on that. Now, with Martha, it resulted in anger and hostility toward Jesus. In Paul's situation, he prayed and the prayers weren't answered. Where are the promises? God promised to answer the prayer of the righteous. Well, wasn't Paul righteous enough? Didn't he have enough faith? Well, the prayers weren't answered, but Paul learned something in that. He learned that when he was weak, then God was strong in him. So he said, gladly will I accept my weakness. I will be proud of my thorn, in almost. In other words, this is the doorway for the Holy Spirit to work through me. Now, where does that come from? You wouldn't get that from Joel Osteen. But it is a powerful picture of what Jesus is talking about here and what the psalmist is talking about. You delivered me. You've turned my mourning into dancing. You have not, and you've done that without changing my circumstances. It would look something like this. The path of mourning to dancing. We have anger, anxiety, despair. All of us experience that. It leads to not bitterness and shame, but to spiritual self-audit, where I ask myself, why am I feeling this way? Where is it coming from? Insight into expectations, perspectives, and priorities. Where is my perspective too narrow? Where are my priorities misplaced? Why are my expectations out of line? And then to repentance and mind renewal, where the light comes on and say, okay, now I understand. I've got some stuff in my backpack I haven't dealt with, and it's all creeping out here. I need to unpack that and find out just exactly where this has come from, what's there, and deal with it. And then experience first inner peace, and then I have the freedom to love, worship, and serve. It's really difficult to come to a worship service and worship God when you feel as though basically God hasn't showed up for you. And that's the experience that a lot of people have. They say, I've got all these problems. Where was God? And very frankly, I think one of the greatest challenges that our culture faces, our world faces, when we try to tell people about the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they look at the world around us and they say, basically, where has your God been? This God who is all-powerful, all-loving, and basically answers your prayers, will not allow his people to go hungry or to suffer harm. Ha, a joke. Now, the thing that is not a joke is the fact that the writers of the New Testament and Jesus himself lived in the same world we live in. Same disappointments, same false expectations, same lies of the enemy, which says basically God is going to make heaven come to earth. They lived in the same environment, and they found peace, and they found shalom to be real. Paul, when he was in prison, he never prayed to get out.
And he never mentioned Nero.
No, he never mentioned Nero. I mean, we'd have been all over Nero's back. But he doesn't. Amazing, amazing. And I've said this before. The reason I am involved in ministry is because of the testimony of the Apostle Paul. And you say, I basically view everything through the writing of Paul. Well, that's to a certain extent true. And part of that is because when I read his story, I said, whatever he's got, I want to find out what it is. Because if he could give up what he did as a Pharisee in a position of power and respect and go to where he had to go in prison and eventually martyred, and do that with a kind of peace and freedom to love that he had, I said, that is a real treasure. That's what I want. And I may not understand it. I still don't. Very frankly, I don't understand why. I was just watching this special on those who have come out of North Korea. And boy, it's hard to sleep at night when you hear what people in North Korea are going through. But not just in North Korea, it's other parts of the world too. You know, how can a just loving God permit innocent, quote unquote, people, children, to suffer generations in a prison camp because an uncle someplace said something that the emperor didn't like? It's hard for us to understand how human beings can treat one another this way, and for a God who made us in his image can stand by and let it happen. I don't understand that. But I know that Jesus lived in that world. Paul lived in that world. And I'm reading this book I've shared with you, many of you, Tried by Fire, the first 1,000 years of the Christian church. I'm amazed at how many hundreds of thousands of Christians have lived in this world, that kind of world of injustice. And yet they died for their faith. They were convinced that this shalom would become a part of our experience in part, not fully, through the Holy Spirit. That when we follow Christ, our hope basically is in a perspective that's broad, an expectation that's realistic. We are not living in fantasy world. And priorities that are ordered more like Mary than like Martha. And that's where we worship. And that's where we find the freedom to love, even those who have hurt us. Turning mourning to dancing. Some biblical examples that come to mind. Mary and Martha, passage you read. Paul's thorn in the flesh. Joseph's captivity into Egypt. You remember the story in Genesis chapters 46 and 50. Joseph was sold by his brothers because of jealousy into Egypt as a slave. And later, during a famine, they come back to him. And in chapter 50 of Genesis, Joseph says, "You meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. For this day I will deliver my brethren." The point is, the things that happen to us, if we can get past the insult they are from a narrow perspective and broaden the perspective and see how God might use this, even in ways in which we perhaps can never understand, but just trust him that he can use this in some way when we respond in a godly way, it changes everything. Joseph becomes a patriarch that we admire, and he becomes really a model of Messiah in many respects because of his attitude. And of course, the greatest example is Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. His perspective was broad. He saw beyond his circumstances and what he was facing. And even though those circumstances were dire and painful for him, he said, "Lord, if it's possible, if there's any way you can get me out of this, please do it. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to hell for people. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be separated from you. But nonetheless, your will be done." And in Philippians, Paul says of Jesus, "For the joy set before him, he endured that suffering." That's a challenge for us. I don't know what you're going through in your life. I'm sure that many of the challenges you face are much worse than technology that doesn't work. But it can be little or big. It makes no difference. Our response basically is going to be challenged the same way. How do we see this as an opportunity to learn and to audit and to repent and to be free? And to what extent do we allow this to go into our backpack, our knapsack, and basically build up and come out someplace else, destroying our ability and freedom to love, making worship a joke for us, and eventually leading to depression? Okay, we've got how many more minutes?
Eight.
Any additions, subtractions, corrections? Next week we're going to talk about peacemaking. How do you become a peacemaker as opposed to a warmonger?